for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Many of us hold major misconceptions about what it takes to succeed in the business world and other walks of life. That's the conclusion Wharton Business School professor Adam Grant came to when he began studying success. We've been taught that unselfish, giving people rarely rise to the top. But Grant argues the most successful people are often also the most giving. His book is titled Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. Adam Grant joins me in the studio. You are welcome to be part of the program. Give us your own experiences. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you, sir. It's good to have you here.
Good morning. I'm honored to be here.
Thank you. I think a good many people begin their whole work life with the idea of, if I don't take care of myself, nobody else will. You have a very different perception.
I think that's probably true. I think that a lot of people go in thinking it has to be all about me. And yet, most organizations are really interdependent. You have to collaborate with other people. You have to serve clients. And so oftentimes, helping others is a way to actually rise to the top.
Helping others, rising to the top. One usually thinks of people rising to the top because of hard work, ambition, drive. You're putting it in a whole different perspective. Explain it.
Sure. So I think that the basic idea is we start, when we evaluate people coming into an organization, we tend to look at their talent and, you know, their skills. But at the end of the day, how much value they add isn't just how much talent they have, but also how much they can actually contribute to their colleagues, to their customers, and really whether they can use their skills to benefit others and help other people rise to the top.
So you've looked at several decades of social science to come up with this book, and you talk about givers, matchers, and takers. Help us understand who they are.
We all know successful people who are takers, you know, who try to get as much as possible from others and contribute as little as they can in return. They tend to self-promote, they love to claim credit, sometimes even backstab. And then you have, on the other end of the spectrum, these people that I call givers who actually enjoy contributing more to others than they receive in return and will frequently do things like make an introduction, share knowledge, offer mentoring with no strings attached. And most of us aren't purely takers or givers. Most of us fall somewhere in the middle. And I use the term matchers, which is basically people who try to maintain an even balance of give and take, reciprocity, quid pro quo. If I help you, I expect you to help me.
So what percentage would you guess would fall into each camp?
So it varies a lot by industry and culture, of course. But in most of the studies that I've done and others have done as well, about twice as many people score in the matcher category as opposed to the taker or giver.
Where do the givers fall?
So the givers fall and rise in the sense that they're overrepresented both at the bottom and the top of most success metrics.
Really?
This was a big surprise to me, actually. So if you look at studies of the worst engineers and the best engineers, both of those groups actually tend to be incredibly generous. And the takers and matchers are more likely to be in the middle when you look at their productivity or their work quality.
Why did you get into all this? Why did you begin looking at who gives, who takes, who matches?
So there were a lot of factors that I think really stimulated this interest. But one of the ones that kept happening was I was working with students and with leaders who had the same experiences of being really helpful, generous, compassionate people in life, you know, with their families, with their friends, and then believing that they had to come into the workplace and all of a sudden be self-serving and cutthroat. And, you know, I thought it was a little bit of a travesty that they had to check their values at the office door. And I began to wonder, is that actually true or is it just a misconception?
And what about the age factor? How does that work into this?
So there's some wonderful work. This is Dan McAdams and his colleagues actually showing that people tend to become much more generous as they approach midlife. And I think some of that is driven by, you know, gaining mastery and skills that you can actually pass forward to a younger generation. And some of that is also reflecting on, you know, the contributions that you've made and thinking about what do I want to leave behind.
And what about young people?
What about young people? Well, there's actually a terrific book by Gene Twenge called Generation Me, making the case that the millennial generation is more entitled, more selfish, more narcissistic than any on record. And I think that there are some data suggesting that. There are also data, though, suggesting that young people are incredibly concerned about giving back and helping others and making a difference. And I think that we probably need to work on designing organizations that give people an outlet for expressing those values.
How do you do that?
Well, I think one of my favorite ways to do that is a little activity that Wayne Baker and his colleagues call the Reciprocity Ring. This is out at HUMAX Networks and part of the University of Michigan. What they do is they bring together groups of people in about 12 or 15 and ask everybody to make a request. It could be anything you want, personal or professional, that you couldn't get on your own. And then you basically open up the floor for people to try to volunteer to help each other. And these amazing things are accomplished. People are able to sometimes meet a favorite celebrity or go and, you know, open a door for a job they didn't think they could get access to. And I think that I would love to see more groups and organizations coming together where you can sort of match up people who are seeking help with those who can actually offer it.
Your first chapter offers one of your favorite examples of a giver, and that's David Hornick. Tell us about him.
David Hornick is this very inspiring venture capitalist who I think has broken many of the rules of the industry. He's a guy who organizes conferences and actually invites competing firms to meet entrepreneurs. And he's also somebody that has been willing to drop a lot of things on his calendar to mentor people that he's never met. And he really believes that creating value for other people is the best way for everyone to win in the long run, even though being generous in the short run may involve some costs.
Such as?
Well, I think that sometimes what happens is he's occasionally run into situations where people think that, you know, he's a little bit too friendly and too warm to succeed in a tough business world. And that for me is a myth that I really want to debunk. Givers are not necessarily nice, soft, touchy-feely people. In fact, there are a lot of people who are incredibly tough and sort of challenging in their demeanor, but at the end of the day have others' best interests at heart.
But you know, in today's job market, it would seem to perhaps many people who are looking for jobs that what they have to show in an interview, in a letter, in any kind of presentation is, I am tough, I'm your man, I can get things done, rather than, you know, I know how to collaborate. I have worked with such and such people before we together did this. I mean, it does seem as though the market is pushing people in that direction.
I think there are times in a job interview, certainly, where being able to stand up and, you know, sort of highlight your potential contributions and your talents is important. I would ask the question, though, how did you get your foot in the door for that job interview in the first place? And I think that's often where the givers end up gaining some unexpected rewards. And one way to look at this, actually, is to look at what the matchers do. So if you're a matcher, you really believe in a just world and you think what goes around ought to come around. And what that will mean is you spend a lot of your time trying to punish takers so that they get what they deserve, sometimes even through gossip. And at the same time, actually trying to really sort of lift up givers and make sure they get rewarded for their generosity. And so I think that the matchers are actually often plotting the well-being of the helpful, generous people around us and helping them actually get those job interviews in the first place.
There are a number of older people in jobs, very much like mine. Younger people are saying, you know, it's time for you guys to move on so we can move up. And perhaps those at the top think, yeah, it's time for me to give up and move out. And yet, at the same time, there is that willingness to share, but maybe not to move on.
Yeah, I think there are probably multiple ways of being a giver, right? So I'm not suggesting that people should self-sacrifice. And in fact, givers who consistently put other people first and neglect their own interests and goals end up typically, I find, becoming doormats or burning themselves out or both. I think the question is really, what are the ways that you can contribute to others while still advancing your own goals and maintaining your own ambitions? And I think that sharing knowledge and mentoring is one of the most powerful ways to do that.
Tell me how you've done that at the Wharton School.
So I'm the first to say this is a learning process for me. And actually, I've taken a lot of insights from the people that I interviewed for
good,
the book and the studies that I've done. For me, a lot of that is trying to set clear boundaries about who it's most important to me to help. And so, you know, number one, of course, is my family. My wife and daughters are the most important priority in my life. And then second is my students. I had some extraordinary professors who were deeply caring and really changed the way that I saw the world and invited me to try to get into some research that led me to where I am. And so I've always wanted to try to pay that forward. And then sort of colleagues end up in the third position. And so those priorities have been helpful for me when I evaluate requests to say, okay, where do people fall in that hierarchy?
Adam Grant, his new book is titled Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. Adam Grant is the youngest tenured professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, a former junior Olympic springboard diver and professional magician. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, talk more and take your calls. Welcome back. Adam Grant is with me. He is a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, author of a brand new book. It's titled Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. Adam, during the break, you and I were talking about what's happening on Capitol Hill. Do you see examples of give and take going on there?
I think it's always hard to judge from afar, and so you would be in a much better position to answer that question than I would. But I do think that, you know, if you look at all the political scandals that have broken recently, there have been some really disturbing cases of taking in politics. And I think that a lot of takers are really good fakers in that, you know,
fakers.
They create an air of generosity and, you know, sort of maintain this facade to get where they want to go. And then, of course, have really self-serving motives behind a lot of their actions.
Now, the other questions relate to how people who are at such polar opposite ends of an issue, for example, taxes. If you're talking about the givers and the takers, how do you bring those two together to create a consensus that can work for the country? It is the country that is at stake.
Yeah, I wish I had a good answer to that. And I think that, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not going to be the first to call for more bipartisan dialogue. I think if you look back to the way that Abraham Lincoln ran his government, I love Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns Goodwin. And it's just a fascinating look at actually how he was willing to bring in his bitter rivals, because he really believed that diversity of thought and dialogue actually led to the best decisions. And I think we've moved away from that model since Lincoln's era. And so I would love to see more of those opportunities created.
How to begin converting oneself or indeed an organization to be convinced of the value of giving as opposed to taking?
I think one of the first steps is actually to become more thoughtful about actually evaluating who's a giver, who's a taker, and who's a matcher. I think a lot of people end up giving to takers and they get taken advantage of and they learn that it's really risky and dangerous to give, which is true. It's less risky and dangerous if you're giving to matchers who tend to reciprocate and pay it back, or if you're giving to fellow givers who will often try to multiply and create sort of ripple effects and let other people benefit from the giving. And so I think that really the first step is to try to figure out who are the other givers in your network or in your organization, and then how can you actually target your acts of helping and contributing toward them so that they reach the broadest audience of people.
When you do that, are you talking about reaching outside the organization, or are you talking about converting the takers into givers within the organization? And if so, how?
I think there are opportunities to do both. I think many of us have to look outside if we are in a pretty competitive and cutthroat organization. But there are ways. I don't think it's easy, but there are ways to convert takers. My favorite, of course, is to try to shine a spotlight on them. Nobody wants to be a taker in a visible way, and everybody knows it's bad for their reputation. And a lot of takers get away with it because, they end up basically taking advantage of people behind closed doors or in the dark. And so I would look at mechanisms for making what knowledge people share, what helping they do, more visible and transparent so that it's harder to get away with being stingy.
Here's an email which says, this is simply a recipe for life, not just work. As a recent convert to Buddhism, we know happiness is found in giving and making others happy. That's where our rewards are, no matter work or not. Life is happier all the way around. Do you agree with that?
So I've been looking at the data on this for a long time, and I think it's true in the long run. There's a lot of evidence suggesting that people who help others do experience the greatest long-term joy and satisfaction. But it can be costly in the short term, right? If you give up your day to really benefit someone else, there are times when that can be frustrating or can leave you feeling like you're behind on your own work. I think where the real psychological advantages of giving lie are really in meaning and purpose. There's some wonderful work by Jennifer Ocker and her colleagues suggesting that people actually who live their lives like givers experience a greater sense of meaning on a day-to-day basis because they feel like their actions really matter.
Here's another email. I think the altruism that your guest is talking about usually occurs after they have used Machiavellian tactics to rise to the top. Once established, they balance it out by being nice now that they have what they want.
So I think this is a myth that I would love to challenge, actually, and say, yeah, there are a lot of people who succeed first, maybe even as takers, at least as matchers, and then try to start giving back. But I've also been really struck by evidence that some of the people who achieve the greatest success later are those who started by giving. And as one small illustration of that, there's this wonderful study by the economist Arthur Brooks, who shows that if you give money away to charity one year, you actually earn more money the following year. And he can't explain this. How do you make money by giving it away? But it turns out, actually, that the giving does lead to this boost in meaning and happiness that leads people to want to work harder and actually earn more so they can give even more away.
How fascinating. Here's another from Jay, who says, a lot of the generosity of people climbing the ladder is strategic. Maybe nothing returned right away, but a definite play to benefit down the line.
I think that's true. And either, you know, that would be the strategy of really effective takers who have become good fakers or very thoughtful matchers. At the same time, the pattern that I love on this is a phrase that translates from Dutch to kissing up, kicking down, where, you know, the people who are giving strategically tend to do it to impress powerful and influential people. And so, you know, I would really look at how are the people that you're evaluating treating, you know, people laterally and below them.
And how to evaluate. So what are the terms you use to evaluate?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it is, you know, as people pursue their own goals, are they actually looking out for, you know, giving credit and sharing, you know, credit with the people who have contributed perhaps below them? Are they, you know, when they have the opportunity, actually singing the praises of other people who have done really extraordinary work? Or is it all about me, I and me, as opposed to us and we?
You write about something called lekking, L-E-K-K-I-N-G. What in the world is that, and how does it apply to the corporate world?
So lekking is a term that comes out of the animal kingdom. It's usually a mating dance. Think of male peacocks, for example, sort of, you know, parading and trying to attract, you know, the most desirable of mates. And what I argue is that there are actually a lot of CEOs, especially in the business world, who end up doing a dance that looks a lot like that.
Kenneth Lay.
Yeah, I think, you know, he was a really sad example of trying to sort of appear as generous and helpful and caring as possible, you know, to put on a good show. But I think had many sort of manipulative behaviors that he was hiding behind the surface.
Now, are you saying that there are a lot of people in the corporate world rising on the ladder who are giving generously to charitable organizations just to be seen as givers?
Definitely. There's even a study by Vladis Grishkevicius and his colleagues showing that people will go green to be seen. So if you're buying a product, for example, in public, you will choose the more environmentally friendly one. But if you're buying it on Amazon, where nobody can see your purchases, you'll go to the more luxurious one that doesn't help the environment. And, you know, I think that's an example of many of the kinds of sort of strategic reputation-driven giving that we see.
Here's an email from Siobhan in Hollywood, Florida. At what point does a person say enough to putting others' needs ahead of ours? Is there a point where the well of givers is depleted? And then how are they replenished?
That's a fascinating question. So I guess I would answer it in two ways. One is to say one of the stars of chapter two has this idea of the five-minute favor, which is instead of giving in the most costly ways, think about, can I add high value to others at minimal cost to me? And I think that that's something that I'd love to see more givers thinking about.
Explain that more.
So I think a lot of it is about saying, look, you know, we tend to think of giving as, you know, spending hours and hours of sort of time and selfless sacrifice. But, you know, a lot of the most valuable contributions you can make to other people are, you know, making a quick introduction or, you know, sharing an article, giving some fast advice or feedback, or, you know, even going out of your way to praise and acknowledge, you know, the sort of invisible work of somebody who's really working hard.
Do you think women tend to be more in the giver category than do men?
I would give that a qualified yes. I've been reading through the data on this one as well, and there's an analysis by Alice Eagley and her colleagues suggesting that men and women don't differ overall in the frequency of their helping behaviors, but they differ in where they target them. So women tend to do more giving and helping toward people they're in close relationships with, friends, family members, close colleagues. Men tend to do a little bit more helping and giving towards strangers.
Strangers?
A lot of this, I think, comes in, you know, moments where there's a need for a hero, right? So the data say men are more likely to jump into a burning building, for example, you know, to save somebody than women are. And I think that there's some evolutionary thinking that, you know, this might be a great way for men to show off their generosity and their bravery to gain status. And I might argue that, you know, the giving in close relationships is probably a little bit more, you know, more altruistic.
It's interesting because I tend to think of a man jumping in to save someone as doing it purely instinctively, not thinking so much about the reflection of heroism. What do you think?
I think there's a case to be made for both. I think a lot of it depends on how much advance notice you have. And I think that, you know, a lot of times people do act on instinct.
Yeah. And do so because they believe it's their duty to help another human being without thinking about reflected glory. At least, you know, when you hear interviews with individuals who've jumped into a river, who've jumped into a fire, who've pulled someone from a burning car, it does seem to be those who acted totally altruistically and instinctively.
Yeah, I think that's often true, although it's interesting, you know, how often they will not admit it. There's this book by Robert Wuthnow, Acts of Compassion, where he went and interviewed the kinds of people who were doing these incredible acts of heroism. And when he asked them, why did you do it? Their most common answer was, well, you know, it kept me out of the house.
Oh. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And, of course, Adam Grant is giving throughout this interview. He's offering others credit for their work on the air. His new book is titled Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. Let's open the phones and go to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning, Nate. You're on the air.
Hello, Diane. Thank you so much for taking my call. You are a national treasure.
Oh, thank you.
Adam, I'm really hoping you can comment to my one about servant leadership. I think it's so important to note that so many entrepreneurs start out as servants. Before they can create a successful business, they have to look at the eyes, the problems, through someone else's perspective. When they create a good product or service that's never been done before or filling a need, they have to start thinking about the other person, their end consumer, first. And so it's so important to realize that so many entrepreneurs are servants to begin with. And I'm hoping you can continue that conversation, Adam.
Yeah, I think it's a great observation. And, you know, in looking back, it's probably my biggest regret about the book is that I didn't spend more time on the servant leadership angle. I love Robert Greenleaf's work on servant leadership. And I think what I started doing when I wrote the book was trying to get away from writing a leadership book, because there are so many business and psychology books that are speaking to people at the top. And I wanted to write a book that anybody could read and take some insights out of. And I think I may have pushed that too far, but I think the idea of servant leadership really embodies many of the values and principles that I've been studying and that capture what givers tend to do.
So explain what you mean precisely and broadly by servant leadership.
So when I think about servant leadership, I think about a leader saying, my first and foremost responsibility is to serve and contribute to the interests of the people who work with me and for me and depend on my products or my services. And so, you know, instead of just maximizing shareholder value, my role is actually to try to help other people achieve their goals.
Can you spot a giver or a taker from a photograph?
There is some evidence to suggest that you can. There's this amazing study by Chatterjee and Hambrick who found that in companies' annual reports, the takers actually tended to have larger photographs. And so it kind of sent this message, it's all about me. I'm the most important person in this company.
And do women do that equally?
So these data came from the computer industry, where there were not as many women at the helm as I would have liked to see. But my hunch would be probably less so.
Probably less so, but no way. But you think you can spot a taker just from, say, a Facebook profile?
I think we can get some clues. There's some work by Keith Campbell and his colleagues suggesting that takers actually post vainer photos of themselves on Facebook. And so I always like to think about this in terms of, you know, look at your average photo and then how much more attractive is your profile photo than your typical photo? Are you really trying to put your best foot forward?
And what it is you say about yourself?
Yeah, there's some evidence, too, that the takers tend to do more self-promoting. You know, they will tend to write status updates that are about the great things that they've accomplished.
As opposed to saying simply who and what they are?
Exactly. Or even, you know, sharing things that other people have done and recognizing and celebrating other people's accomplishments.
Are you on Facebook?
I am.
And what do you have up there?
So it's actually been a really interesting process to figure out what's the right balance between, you know, actually fulfilling my commitment to trying to spread these ideas and at the same time trying to recognize others. So first thing is you will not find any giant photos of me on there. But secondly, I've tried to make sure that most of what I share is about recognizing other people's really interesting and important work.
So you would consider yourself a giver?
I think it's really hard to judge this, you know, when you look at yourself. I really try to live by these principles as often as I can, but you'd have to ask people who interact with me to really know.
Adam Grant, he's the youngest tenured professor at the Wharton School. Short break.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org, by the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Washington Post economics writer Neil Irwin talks about the extraordinary power of central bankers.
If you have a central banker and you have a printing press and you have the authority of the state imbued in both, you can create money from thin air.
Irwin's new book is The Alchemist, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire. Join us.
Welcome back. Some harsh emails here, Adam. One says, this approach is extremely naive and fraught with danger. I was a proactive new business owner, tried my best to involve my staff, to respect them, and provide them with everything they required. I was seen as weak. A small group of them bullied me, eventually destroyed the business, my life, the lives of 30 of the staff, and the lives of the customers. They went on to join competitors, taking customers with them. If the employer is a giver and any group of employees are takers, this cannot work. Enough will never be enough for the takers, whatever their position. They can be so destructive, they don't care who they ruin. Wow. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I'm very sorry to hear about that experience.
Me too.
Secondly, I would say, you know, there's a lot of wisdom in it. I think that giving to takers is really dangerous. And I think that one of the things that I've learned from the research in the book is to be a lot more thoughtful and careful about screening, you know, the people who seek me out for help. And if somebody is a taker, I've tried to be much more of a matcher and say, look, I'm going to help this person, but expect some kind of reciprocity. And I often feel uncomfortable, you know, asking for something back. So I will frequently instead ask that person to pay it forward and help somebody else that I'm trying to help. But I think, you know, more broadly, I do think that it's really difficult to sustain, you know, success in a culture of takers as a giver. I do think, though, that most people have matcher instincts and that there are often opportunities to appeal to those instincts.
Here is a caller in Homewood, Alabama. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Diane and Adam, thank you so much for the show. I have a question. I work in an environment that is a little toxic at times, and there are, I feel like, two of us that I would consider givers. And it's a strange thing that I feel happens that we try to outgive each other. And lately, I found myself questioning, are we really giving or are we trying to appear as givers?
What a great question, Adam.
Yeah, I think it's always hard to know what people's motives are. And Key and Peele did this hilarious video last month where they were trying to one-up each other with favors in exactly the way that you're describing, Elizabeth. I think that the easiest way for me to try to answer this question is to try to look at what happens when the behavior isn't visible. So, you know, if you end up giving in situations only when, you know, your coworker is going to see it or when other people are going to give it credit, there's obviously a little bit more image and impression management involved than if you do the same behavior when nobody's watching and there's never an opportunity to be recognized for it.
And let's go to Ashland, Kentucky. Jerry, you're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call, Diane.
Sure.
I'm a big fan of the show. Adam, this is such a timely topic. I actually just last week accepted and was offered a position as the new director for the chapter of the United Way that covers northeastern Kentucky.
Well, congratulations to you.
Thank you. I am thrilled and very excited to be representing such a great organization. And I was just curious with, I'm obviously going to pick up a copy of this book, and I was just curious as to whether or not you had any insights or suggestions or advice for me as I begin this new career that is obviously so involved with businesses.
Let me just ask you, how many people will you be involved with?
In what way?
Will you be supervising a group of employees?
I will be probably supervising just one or two employees that are. We will work on a very small staff.
All right.
But we will be working with the community at large, with all of the businesses as United Way has for many, many years.
Good, Adam.
Congratulations, Jerry. I think that, you know, in my experience with studying and working with nonprofit organizations, the biggest challenge that I've encountered is giver burnout of, you know, people who are so committed to the mission or the cause that they forget to take care of themselves. And I try to cover a lot of my own findings on this in Chapter 6. But I think the biggest takeaway that I've, I guess, discovered in my research is givers don't always burn out when they just give too much. They tend to burn out when they don't get to see their impact and understand how their efforts are benefiting other people. And so I would, I guess, suggest, you know, without knowing more details, it would be really interesting to say, can you find people who are really benefiting in meaningful ways from the United Way's work and actually bring them front and center so that your staff can hear their stories?
That's a great suggestion. Good luck to you, Jerry. I hope all goes well. Here's an email from Nisha in Florida. Is there a correlation between those who are naturally givers and their success in personal relationships? I would think them to be better suited, but maybe not.
So we're stepping outside of my organizational psychology expertise here. So I'm going to take a leap and say that there's some terrific work by Margaret Clark and her colleagues showing that in marriages and romantic relationships, norm of giving tends to be the most sustainable as long as it's not too unbalanced, so that one side is doing all the giving and the other's doing all the receiving.
So it needs to be mutual.
Yeah, I think that there's some other work by Carol Rosbold and her colleagues showing that couples that maintain an equilibrium where, you know, they're willing to help each other anytime without keeping score, but it's not all on one side or the other, are actually more likely to be satisfied and sustain their marriages.
To Redford, Redford, Virginia. Good morning, Grant.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I spent 30 years in management, and I've been out of it for about the last 10 years or so, and I really am considered a dinosaur when it comes to management. And hearing Mr. Grant's comments about how he didn't intend to write a leadership book, it sounds really as though he did, because he's basically referring to going back to a leadership. A good leader always surrounds himself with people who knows more about a subject than he does. And he's confident enough in his leadership to be able to bring them together. And sort of like Lee Iacocca. And we really haven't had any big business leaders since they've gotten away from that.
Tell me why you believe this is a revolutionary approach to success, which is your subtitle.
So I think that, you know, most people, when they try to achieve success, really look for, you know, okay, what is the shortest and straightest path to meeting my own self-interest? And, you know, very few of us say, how can I actually climb to the top in ways that lift other people up as opposed to cutting them down? And so, you know, I think the different idea here is really that you can succeed in ways that bring others along with you.
Do you believe that there is a comparison in your work to that of Lee Iacocca?
I think it's hard to say. I do think there's certainly a common theme in terms of trying to figure out how do you advance collective interests, you know, through the vision that you create and the leadership that you bring to the table. But there's a book that I absolutely love that I think spells out this philosophy beautifully for leadership. It's called Multipliers by Liz Wiseman. And it's about whether a leader is a genius or a genius maker. And obviously the givers fall into the latter category.
Interesting. What about the matchers? Talk about the matchers. Shouldn't they be the ones who really are successful?
I think the matchers are playing it safe. And I think that, you know, if you want to be, you know, a good and decent person, and you also want to make sure that you don't get burned or burned out, matching is a very, very safe strategy. At the same time, I think that matching comes along with two risks. One is creating sort of a transactional flavor, you know, that there's always some expectation of return. And the other is sort of limiting your interactions to people that you think you can help or who can help you. Whereas I think givers often create a wider and richer network of people that they don't have expectations of benefiting from help from, but often do in the long run.
Should a matcher aspire to become a giver?
I wouldn't tell anyone to aspire to anything, but I think that there are ways in which matchers are able to, you know, improve their own success and their own well-being by incorporating some principles that givers follow.
Tell me about your own history. I mean, as the youngest tenured professor at the Wharton School, how did this philosophy work its way into your rise to success?
I think that's a very hard question to answer. You know, I guess throughout my career, I've tried to look at the behaviors of my role models and take a page out of those. And let me highlight just a couple. Growing up in diving, my coach, Eric Best, was extraordinarily generous and gave countless hours to try to help me improve as a very, very poor diver. And, you know, just really led
but
me
you
to...
you did reach the Olympics, so therefore you, from being a poor diver, rose to being an Olympic diver.
Well, there's a far, far leap from Junior Olympics to Olympics. But, you know, Eric led me to really believe that I could accomplish things greater than I thought possible. And then when I got to college, Brian Little was my mentor. And as a psychology professor, I sat down with him to meet for about half an hour to talk about thesis ideas. And he spent 3 hours with me, giving me advice, and then took me under his wing and really fundamentally changed my life.
Wow. And is still having an impact on your life?
Every day. There's hardly a moment that goes by where I don't ask, what would Brian do in this situation?
Interesting. You asked me earlier who were the two most giving people I've ever interviewed. I think one of them would be Mr. Rogers. Did you happen to know or grow up with Mr. Rogers?
I used to watch him tie his shoes every morning.
Well, I mean, I think he really, really was. And the second person I would name is Audrey Hepburn. She came in after she had become the UN ambassador to many poor countries representing UNICEF. And she was so gaunt. She was so, I mean, it looked as though she could expire at any moment. She was already suffering from cancer. And yet, there she was, continuing to give. So both of those stand in my mind as people who worked so hard and gave at the same time they were working and rose to the top. Adam Grant is with me. His new book is titled Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go here to Kaufman County, Texas. Good morning, Ron. You're on the air.
Yes, Diana. Thank you for taking my call, and you are a national treasure.
Oh, thank you.
I think the best description of a hero I ever heard, a quick comment, is an ordinary person caught in extraordinary circumstances.
Sure.
But the my comment is, as a small businessman, I find honesty is the main thing that employers want. Honesty of what you know, what you can train. But you do a battle when you try to take a servant-type attitude, which is really what he's describing, it sounds like, which I found out later in my business career. And look, self-examination of myself led me to this conclusion and how people viewed me, my employers and customers. And that changed my attitude about it. But you do run, because of dishonesty and because employees are takers, you run into a situation quite often where you get so burned out as an employer in giving young people an opportunity to train them and to have them succeed. Now, it does come with great reward sometimes when you see them succeed. I've never been disappointed to hear an employee quit and go on to a better thing. It's when they quit because they're just not happy with the amount of pay or they think they've got a better thing.
Sure.
But it seems like they always want to come back and to work for a paycheck, or they want to come back and thank you for what you taught them.
Adam.
Yeah, I think that I would say two things to that. The first one is I think all of us face trade-offs, you know, between honesty and other values we care about, like loyalty. You know, I think that there are times when there's even some research on altruistic lies, the idea that, you know, you might fib a little bit to protect somebody else's interests. That being said, you know, I think dishonesty among takers is a challenge for many organizations. And you know, I think Jim Collins is famous for saying you got to get the right people on the bus. But I think he also said something that's even more important, which is you need to keep the wrong people off the bus. Hmm. And I think that I'd love to see employers spending more time actually screening for takers in the hiring process.
You write about John Huntsman Sr., the father of former Utah governor and presidential candidate John Huntsman Jr. How did being a giver make him rich?
Well, I think Huntsman's story is fascinating, and I drew most of the examples in the book from his book, Winners Never Cheat. And one of the things that Huntsman writes about is how early in life, you know, his goal was to accumulate wealth that he could give back to help people in need. And I think that, you know, one thing is that really motivated him to work harder and longer. But two, I think it actually might have built his willpower. Because, you know, there are these moments where his impulse may be to try to protect his own interests, and he overrides those impulses to try to help. And over time, he actually gains extra willpower and discipline from working that muscle over and over.
And what about the younger Huntsman? Did he inherit those traits?
I don't know him personally, so it's hard to say, but I've spoken to a number of people who have worked with him that have described him as incredibly generous and helpful with the people that he interacts with. And so it wouldn't surprise me if he did.
And that's really the key here, isn't it? To be generous, to be kind, to be cautious, discerning, but in the end, to be as giving as possible.
I think as giving as possible, as long as it doesn't sacrifice your own interests, yes.
Adam Grant, his new book is titled Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. Good luck to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from